This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
Good morning, this is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Keith Kam. Malaysia has just celebrated her 65th year of independence and we are still right smack in the middle of Bulan Kemerdekaan, which culminates on September 16th, Hari Malaysia, which is the 59th anniversary of our nation as it is today. How far have we come in the past six decades and what does it mean, especially for younger Malaysians going forward? This morning, we have with us one of those younger Malaysians, Keadilan's Nik Nazmi Nik Ahmad, the current Member of Parliament for Setia Wangsa. He recently released his latest book, Malaysian Son, which chronicles his life and, in his words, it's a way for us to keep him accountable. Nazmi, let's start with the fact that Malaysia will have been Malaysia for 59 years soon. Until today, there are several issues that continue to rumble under the surface, sometimes boiling over, but more often than not suppressed. We are still suffering from racial and religious differences, and often these issues are amplified by political parties. 20 plus years in politics, do you see a way out of this?
Well, the way for me was multiracial parties, right? For me, you know, I found that one of the major problems when you have race and religious-based parties is that, you know, every party will have their own internal elections. So when you are race-based or religious-based, you will then tack to your core support. Just like if you're in the US, you're a Democrat, you'll be more left-wing in your party primary than in a general election. And you move to the center when it's a general election. In Malaysia, what happens is that you do that when it's your party elections, you become more racial, you become more religious extremist.
You build up the rhetoric.
Yes. I mean, just to get the votes. And then, you know, you become a nation builder when it comes to general elections. A lot of it is rhetoric, but obviously when you go through so many of those cycles, it's actually very dangerous. You know, right. It spills into real problems. When you have a multiracial party, you know, and Keadilan is, I think, you know, it is the most successful multiracial party in Malaysia's history. I can't afford to do that. I was up against Malays, Chinese, Indians. You know, we Keadilan, one thing people know is that we are quite open about our camps, but it's always multiracial. And I think then, ideally, you can battle more on issues rather than on race or religion.
But it's been more than 20 years since Keadilan was born. Yep. I mean, do you see any improvement since then? I know there is a lot of improvement in urban areas, but not so much in the rural areas. Do we have hope?
I think we do. You know, I'm now the chief also of Keadilan for Kelantan and Terengganu. That's the biggest or most difficult job that one can get because we don't have any seats. Pakatan Harapan has zero seats in those two states. So, you know, I made it my challenge, you know, to be able to go to those areas, you know, not just in Setia Wangsa or Lembah Pantai or Shah Alam, but to go to the areas in the East Coast and make a case. We definitely failed in 2018. Roughly the estimate when we look at various surveys, our Malay vote in 2018 in the East Coast was around 18%, you know, below 20%. Mm-hmm. In West Coast, Selangor to Johor, you know, the southern West Coast, we got about 40% of the Malay vote. And maybe in areas like Shah Alam, maybe it's 50%. So that means that there's that huge disparity. People like to talk about interracial disparity, but there's also intraracial disparity in terms of how they vote and whatnot. So I think the issue is that we also sometimes the danger is that when we quote unquote, you know, we live in the urban areas or the so-called liberals or those in the Bangsa bubble, for want of a better word, we tend to give up on these voters. We just say, you know, they're just too ignorant. It's important to reach out, right? And so you can't give up and you just can't assume that they are not smart enough. Maybe we haven't done enough work. Maybe we haven't reached out enough. It's the same problem that was faced by the liberals in the US. You know, they gave up on the southern states or in Britain when, you know, Labour gave up on their own core working class areas in the north. So I think we can't fall into that trap.
Besides racial and religious differences, there is the issue of class as well. You opted to put your kid into a Sekolah Kebangsaan, albeit a more diverse one. Mm. You highlight how the haves tend to go for private institutions and international schools. The pandemic from the past years would have clearly widened this divide even further. What do you think voters are looking for more urgently today?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most important things is, you know, we should, you know, when I was growing up, I went to La Salle PJ. You know, I had friends, of mixed backgrounds from Bukit Gasing who were very well-to-do. but I had predominantly Malay Indian kids from the squatter areas those days, Kampung Lindungan, Taman Medan. But that was the environment. Was it picture perfect? No. You know, we had fights, you know which kids tend to end up in the smarter class, but still we had some mix. Today, you know, I go to Lhasa, it's almost entirely Malay. And this is a mission school in PJ, almost entirely Malay, the primary school. So I think
a lot of Malays would have sent their kids to private schools.
Yes. Definitely. And so I think one of the things that we should do is, I think one of the mistakes that government did, and it's probably something unpopular for me to say, is that, you know, they liberalized the admittance to international schools. During my time, I sound old, unless your parents were serving overseas, you can't get into international school as a Malaysian. Now, anyone who can pay can get into international schools. And there's some not so good international school as well. But it's an aspirational thing. It's education. So my point is, if you make national schools work again, how many hours are being put into maths and science as opposed to, say, kemahiran hidup or even religion? I mean, it's a controversial subject, but we have to talk about it. I met a Tamil parent who spoke to me that she sent her kids to Tamil school because they do more maths and science compared to national schools. Tamil school, I mean, let's face it, in the past, even the MIC leaders, they fought for Tamil schools, but they did not send their kids to Tamil schools. Today, you know, even national schools is at the bottom of the rung. So I think those are things that we have to reflect on. And it becomes a vicious cycle, right? Because the more mono-ethnic it becomes, the more teachers, parents then expect it to be like, conform to certain mono-ethnic or mono-religious standards.
The more segregated Malaysia becomes.
Yes. So I think we need to address that. You know, my kid goes to a national school, which is relatively mixed, and I see how the parents are involved, which means that it can be done. But government needs to play a role.
Another theme that struck me in your book was how you advocate for strong check and balances, a strong parliamentary institution backed by free and fair elections. And one major milestone is that Malaysia has passed the anti-party hopping bill. On that note, I actually want to bring up Azmin Ali, what you wrote about him. It's not really surprising. I mean, he is, after all, a politician and super ambitious, but it would seem that the red flags for him had been there all along.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, hindsight is always 20-20, right? I mean, there was a point of time. I used to be quite close to him. Before it was Datuk Sri, and he would come to my house and fetch me, and you know, we go to programs and I can call him Min. So those were the
days. You can't anymore.
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't bother to contact him. But at that time, you know, when we did not see many other leaders, he was seen as, you know, the next leader, you know, young. He was good at communicating, relatively smart, you know. Khalid did a lot of good. I mean, and now that he's passed away, you know, arwah Tan Sri Khalid, but he was not seen as taking care of the political side of things, right? So Azmin sort of had that complete package, you know, but there was always a question. I mean, people did talk about his political operations, how the machine can be quite nasty, but, you know, to be honest, maybe I was blindsided by it. But what struck me was after 2013, I was one of those who actually lobbied for him to immediately replace Khalid after the 2013 elections. I was involved in that. But then I started to hear stories, right? And the way, you know, when we protested the election results, he refused to take part.
I remember that.
And that to me was jarring, you know, why I was... And I ended up in court for that. And then obviously the Kajang move. Then it became more apparent that you know, what was in store with Azmin. And... So I think, you know, obviously by then he had become too big. So unless we defeated him in a party election, which Rafizi nearly did, there was no other way. We couldn't sack him.
But what is PKR doing today to weed out threats like these?
Yeah, one of the things I think is that now our disciplinary board is becoming much more hands-on. And you know, if you have any reports of money politics in party elections or misuse of power and all that, it's being taken much more seriously. And I think it's just to allow that one of the things that may be unpopular and no other party does it, at least no major party in Malaysia does it, is that we have one member, one vote. There's no collegiate system. I mean, UMNO has a wide franchise, but it still is based on the bahagian. So you need to win majority of bahagian. You can win big popular votes, but you need to still get the bahagians. Keadilan is just, you know, you just have to add up everything across the country. And I think that gives the party members some form of control. At the same time, the new system, you know, the Supreme Council is still is now elected by delegates again. So that's because that's much more specialized. So I think that hopefully gives some control by the members over the leadership that they have. No party can remain immune. But I think a continuous renewal of leadership, you know, it's easy to say when you are not a minister or you haven't been there for 10, 20 years. I have been, but not at the highest level. So, but I think as long as things remain competitive, then I think we can minimise that problem.
This morning on The Breakfast Grill, we have with us Nik Nazmi Nik Ahmad, author of Malaysian Sun and the Keadilan MP for Setia Wangsa. On the other side of the break, we'll find out what Malaysia's upcoming 15th general election might look like for the party and Pakatan Harapan as well. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill, where we have with us Nik Nazmi Nik Ahmad, the Keadilan MP for Setia Wangsa, also one of PKR's new four vice presidents and a very young 40 years old. You know, I want to talk about the youth factor now. In the book, you talk a lot about it. You look back fondly at how when you, as PKR's communications director and Rafizi Ramli as the one in charge of strategy, collaborated. Help me understand how that moved things along for the party at the time and what's it look like now?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lifetime ago. Anyone who has worked with Rafizi knows that he's a crazy workaholic. You know, he was really pushing things through. I think we were trying new things to reach out to voters, social media, internet, videos. You know, we were looking a lot at the examples of what political parties abroad were doing in reaching out to the voters. You know, I think we've seen the impact that it has on politics from those days until today. Obviously, you know, Rafizi went on his own path and now he's deputy president of the party. And I think the consistent part is I think people like to see, I mean, there's a general sense that there is a lot of old faces in Malaysian politics for so long, right?
Yeah, I want to bring that up in a while. Yeah.
I expect you to bring it up. You know, from the 1990s, you know, and they desire to see new faces come in. I mean, a lot of us, I mean, across parties, people like Hannah Yeo in Keadilan, like the MB of Selangor or Nurul Izzah, we came in 2008. Mm. So I think that sense of getting more new faces in is exciting. For people youngish. I mean, I wouldn't say we are young, but youngish, because 40s is still generally seen as young in Malaysian politics. Just so that they see, you know, more faces that are new in Malaysian politics, because we've had a prime minister that, you know, is 90 over years old.
Well, you also PKR youth leader at one point. Didn't you see any potential leaders going into the future?
Yes, I did. So, I mean, we're not talking only about people within the party, but also people in civil society. So within the party, my secretary at that time, and he also entered the state assembly at the same time as me, was Chang Li Kang, now Tanjung Malim MP, 42 years old right now. So he was my secretary in the youth wing. Then we've had Akmal Naseh, who was my successor as the youth leader and MP of Johor Bahru. He is 4 years younger than me, 36 years old. And then obviously, I mean, the current youth leader is Adam Adli, who came from civil society, right? So, I mean, I think we've always engaged and, you know, we really go after multiracial and not just Peninsula, but also Sabah Sarawak to incorporate them into mainstream party leadership.
But we keep seeing the same names all the time. I mean, do you, for example, see yourself as party president, eventually maybe even Prime Minister of Malaysia?
No, I think I'll leave that to other leaders, because
you don't have that ambition?
Not personally PM? For me, you know, because I'll end up like Azmin. You say he was super ambitious, right? No, I mean, nothing wrong. I mean, nothing wrong with being ambitious. For me personally, I mean, I'm vice president. So if you're in UMNO, you're vice president, you're prime minister, right?
Correct, yeah.
So I'm already having a lot on my plates. This is not a political answer. It's a real answer where I think that, I mean, I've gone. I mean, there was a point in my life that I said, you know, I want to go all the way up. And that's natural. But you've seen that it actually involves a lot of trade-offs, you know, your personal life, your family life, the scrutiny and everything. And maybe, you know, I think that prime minister is a huge responsibility.
Going into the GE in 2008, you did say that the search for loyal, capable and credible candidates was a real challenge at that time. Is it still the same now?
No, maybe.
I mean, you ended up with quite a number of party hoppers and people who could be bought over.
Yeah, 2008 was really a unique thing because before going to the elections, we were at the lowest point. 2004, we ended up from 5 parliamentary seats. We ended up with 1 parliamentary seat, which was won very narrowly. So a lot of funds were drying up from our funders, sponsors. But not just that, you had people who are very capable, party loyalists, but they say, okay, I'll do anything except for run, because they've had businesses gone, they were sacked from their jobs and whatnot, so they can't afford to do that anymore. And they don't expect us to win. I didn't expect myself to win when I went to that election. This time around, for better or for worse, we are the establishment. If you run in Selangor, in many places, you expect to win if you're a Pakatan Harapan candidate.
Now, most political parties in Malaysia are still hung up on legacy leaders, to put it politely. You have your UMNO and the Najib, Zahid Hamidi, Hishamuddin, DAP and the Lim family. Of course, the influence of Mahathir is palpable everywhere. Anwar Ibrahim is still very much in the picture. Is his leadership still relevant and needed?
I think, Anwar, when we talk about Keadilan, he has definitely still things to offer. Let's not forget, Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn, they weren't actually young, but they inspired a movement among voters, including young voters. But most importantly, I think it's not just Anwar alone. And I think people are starting to see that, i.e. where now people see Rafizi.
Right.
So now the vice presidents, we have 7 vice presidents, of which myself, I'm 40. The MB of Selangor, Amiruddin, is 42. Nurul Izzah is 41. Chang Li Kang is 42. Yeah, so it's largely a very young group of vice presidents, deputy president. In that sort of lineup, I think people can appreciate that we have that second liner, third liner that are going to play a big role in the party for a long time to come.
But how long do you think Anwar should harbour hopes of becoming prime minister?
Well, I think it's not so much about that. It's more about, for him leading the party, going into the general election. And obviously, I think he has stated it quite clearly. In an interview to party leaders, he said he's not going to be a Mahathir. He's not going to stay here and, just grow old in the party.
Meaning he's confirmed that he's going to be the proposed prime minister for the opposition coalition, or are there other names being
Well, as far as we are concerned, he is. The last discussion we had in Pakatan Harapan, it's Anwar Ibrahim. But the thing is that we also have a term limit on the presidency of the party, and he's only into his second term, right? So, he has said that he will not go on and on, right? So I think that's quite clear. It's a very clear message. But the fact is, in the party elections, no one challenged him for presidency. We're not like UMNO where there's a no contest rule and all that. Mm. It's an open field. Anyone can contest. But we still believe that he can play a role going into this election.
Now, today, MUDA, they've begun preliminary discussions with Pakatan Harapan on joining the coalition. What's your take on this? I know they are super gung-ho about it. This is their first GE.
Well, I don't have any major difference. I think, if you talk about MUDA compared to, say, Bersatu or Pejuang, definitely they have more in similarity, in terms of multiracial nature, progressive politics. But I think, rather than getting too gung-ho about joining Pakatan Harapan, I think MUDA has its own strengths, i.e. their appeal where sort of their unique selling point that is slightly different than, say, Pakatan Harapan. So is going into PH the only form of cooperation that will actually really leverage on the strength of PH and MUDA? Or can there be other forms of cooperation? That's one. And secondly, I think there has to be a willingness to discuss and not preempt things. They want to get in, but 15 seats, nothing wrong to have ambition, to have targets. But which seats, right? And those are the details that need to be ironed on. So I think there's still a lot of things. That's why for Pakatan Harapan itself, as it exists today, we are in the midst of our own seat negotiations. And we will focus on that and leave the Presidential Council to discuss further on MUDA.
So bigger picture for GE15, the battleground for GE14 was social media big time. Where will most of the wars be fought during GE15, do you think?
Similar, I think. What do you call that? Now the new element will be TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. depending on which audience you want to talk to. But definitely, I mean, the ground war side, you know, is still important. I mean, we cannot underestimate that. For example, Rafizi has started this initiative, which we are all involved in, called Ayoh Malaysia.
The truck campaign.
The truck campaign. So that one is, you know, it's just like what he did in 2018. Just ceramahs. The party is also starting to do that. And I think slowly, you know, people have started to be interested again.
In GE14, there was a lot of anger over corruption issues like, you know, 1MDB, Tabung Haji. It really galvanized support for PH. What's the fuel this time? I mean, how will you guys weaponize, say, the literal combat ship issue?
Correct. Well, literal combat ship for my area is very relevant because...
yeah, it's military. Yeah.
Yes, I have about 10,000 military voters and probably a few more thousand veterans living in my area. You know, I was surprised. You know, I went to relatively apolitical events, you know, community events, and I didn't expect them to talk politics. They've never spoken politics to me. Suddenly, they were talking about the LCS. But I know that it's quite technical. Not everyone will be interested in it. But it does drive or reinforce this image that UMNO is UMNO, right? And now, you know, people in Bersatu are also dragged into it. But basically, that things haven't changed for them. I think that's crucial, the corruption part. But the second bit is that, you know, the Najib imprisonment.
Yeah.
I think that's also big on two points. It just reminds people of 1MDB again. And secondly, it tells people that their vote was worth something in 2018. You know, at least, you know, when they voted, it meant something. And I think it's something that we can be proud of, Malaysia, not Pakatan Harapan, but Malaysians, Malaysia as a country, we can be proud of that we sent a former prime minister to jail. And thirdly, is the bread and butter issues, which I think is the real battleground because we are talking about, you know, now we have issues of rising cost of living. You know, previously we had the COVID pandemic, especially those who are just into work, those who parents who have kids in school, they really know that, you know, the COVID generation is suffering. And I think that's something that we need to address with a few key radical policies.
Are you contesting?
Yes, I am contesting.
The same constituency?
Well, that's my desire and I've expressed it to the party. The final decision lies with the party president.
Bluntly, what are Pakatan Harapan's chances like, do you think?
Meetings are ongoing for the manifesto, for the rebranding, for the seat negotiation, for the strategy. It's going on a weekly basis involving all the four parties. And generally, it's been very positive. You know, we are not a one-horse coalition like BN, for example, where, you know, people can just say, okay, listen to me. Here, you know, people are, it's a relationship of equal. So obviously there'll be strong opinions. But things are, I think, are moving quite fast. But if you ask me early in the year, you know, going to elections, maybe I would have said it publicly then, but I would tell my closest friends that it's difficult, this general election. But I think with the new, the breath of fresh air from the party elections in Keadilan, and then the Najib imprisonment, the worsening cost of living issue, the UMNO infighting, I think people are starting to appreciate that, you know, we might have a chance this time around. So we just have to work hard. I mean, we can't take things for granted. We just have to work hard and really, you know, double up our work, and I think we can make it in this general election.
Finally, what is your gut feeling about when GE15 will happen? Billion dollar question.
It's difficult because this is only between God and the Prime Minister. You know, maybe the Prime Minister's wife doesn't know. So and again, you know, he can change. You know, now he may want to do it in November, but closer to November, he may have a change of mind. But I think that there is a tension between the Prime Minister and his party, UMNO. UMNO definitely, you know, has publicly stated that he wants to do it early. And I think Prime Minister has publicly stated that, okay, he will, he has made some commitments and whatnot to the party. But, you know, politicians and their word, right? So we'll see. Because this is, for the Prime Minister, this is his most powerful weapon, the date of the general election.
We have been speaking to Nick Nazmi, Nick Ahmad, author of Malaysian Sun and MP for Setia Wangsa, as well as the Parti Keadilan Rakyat Vice President. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Keith Kam for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.